the heart of New York City, near Washington Square. In 1911, March winds were cold and bare. A fire broke out in a building 10 stories high, and 146 young...
This is part two of Out of the Flames and Ashes, The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and Its Legacy, a radio documentary by Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. In part one, we examined the dismal working conditions of garment workers in New York and worker organizing resulting in the massive strike in 1909 and the uprising of the 20,000 leading to unionization throughout the industry, but not in the Triangle Factory, in which a massive fire on March 25, 1911, caused the deaths of 146 workers, mostly young immigrant working women. In part two, we continued this story, exploring how, out of the ashes of this tragedy, workers organized to transform their industry through unionization and legislation, and the legacy of Triangle for today's sweated labor.
Fateful day, dear God, most terrible day. When that fire broke out, it grew into a mighty blaze. In that fire trap way up there, with but a single door, so many innocent working girls burned to live no more.
We didn't hear anything or anybody coming telling us that something is wrong in the building. But we start to smell smoke. And then it became a big panic. Everybody was running to the door, but the door was locked. Everybody was running towards the fire escape. It was overloaded. I figured in my mind, I'm not going to the fire escape. I'm going to go a floor up to see what the executives are doing. When I came to the 10th floor, the flames were over the stairs, and I didn't know how I could make it. So I took my skirt over my head, and I made it. I had to walk down 10 floors by myself, and I stopped on every floor and cried. And when I came to the street, I seen my father. When he seen me, he couldn't believe his eyes, and he fainted. One day, one of the relatives or owners approached me, because the case was going on in court. And they asked me to say that the doors were open. I said, my dear man, why would I lie? The doors were locked. Otherwise, people could save their life. He wanted to bribe me, but nothing done.
I saw Jacob Bernstein, the manager's brother. He was trying to open the door, but it was locked. The flames were coming toward me, and I was being left behind. I heard Margaret yell. Then I said, wait, I will open that door. I tried. I couldn't open it. And then I saw Margaret bending down on her knees. Her hair was loose. I saw the ends of her hair, the trail of her dress, began to burn. She screamed, my God, I am lost. Then a big smoke came, and I yelled, Margaret, but she didn't reply. I tried to get to Margaret, but it was so hot, and the smoke blinded me. I left her. I stood in the center of the room, and I just turned my coat with the fur to my face and the lining on the outside. I got hold of a bunch of dresses that was lying on the examining table, covered my head, and tried to run through the flames. The whole door was red curtain of fire.
I was a floor girl on the 9th floor. I ran pieces of wastes from one station to the next, but I had my own desk, too, right next to the time clock. Every day, I would watch the clock and race to be the first to the door. Everybody would say, "Look out for Ethel!" You had to be quick or else you'd get stuck in line. We all had to wait while the watchman at the Green Street door searched our purses. The door was about 20 feet in front of me and to the left, but the dressing room was on the Washington Place side behind me. I sang myself a little song of what to do when the bell rang. Up, turn, step, 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 coat, hat, run! Saturday was a short day, so the bell rang at 4:45. While the machines were still turning off, I grabbed my pocketbook and hurried to the dressing room to get my coat, my hat, and my new fur muff. I had saved for weeks to buy that muff. Then I seen this girl shouting. You know, she was a very jolly girl. She used to like very much to fool us, often saying, "Here comes the boss, here comes the floor lady," and there was nothing. When I turned my face and I saw she is the one, why then I didn't pay any attention to her. Just ran out of the dressing room to punch my time card.
I was coming from the dressing room when I smelled smoke coming from the Green Street side.
Somebody yelled, "Fire!"
All of a sudden, you got a terrible panic.
I seen some girls rushing to escape. I seen women at other machines become frozen with fear. They were standing with a sort of dazed look on their faces. I tried to go through the Green Street door, and there was a crowd of quick girls there, and I seen I can't get out there.
I ran straight to the fire escape.
I went to the elevator on the Green Street side, and then I heard the elevator go down past us.
I looked down and saw that the fire escape ended in a skylight. There was no way to the street.
The girls were climbing over the machine tables, and so was I. The aisles were narrow and were blocked by the chairs and the baskets, which were beginning to burn. So I jumped from one table to the next without getting down. I was 16 years old, and I could jump. Just as I got to the door, the elevator began to go down. I thought about jumping out, but then I saw in my mind how I would look lying there on the sidewalk, and I got ashamed. I didn't know which way to go. Girls were lying on the floor, fainted. Some were trying to climb over the machines. Others were running with their hair burning. My hair was smoldering. Soon I found myself standing at the edge of the elevator shaft, trying to hold myself back from falling in. I gripped the sides of the open shaft. Behind me, girls were screaming. I could feel them pushing more and more. I knew that in a few seconds, I would be pushed into the shaft. I jumped for the center cable. I began to slide down. I remember passing the floor numbers up to 5. Then something fell and hit me. The next thing I know, I was in a bed in St. Vincent's Hospital, and the first thing that occurred to me was that I had forgotten to take my time card out of the clock. The nun told me not to worry. She told me it was wonderful that I had enough presence of mind when I jumped to wrap something around my hands to save them from injury as I grasped the cable. But it wasn't presence of mind, it was my new fur muff. I wasn't going to lose that muff.
It was 2 days before my 18th birthday. I'd been working at the Triangle Shirtwaist Company for 2 years, and they paid me $9 a week. The first day I came, I said I didn't know anything about sewing, but they said, "That's all right." They had a machine for me, a Julian special. All I had to do was put a button in, and it goes through the waist. That day, we were almost ready to leave. On the 9th floor where I was were the finishers, mostly women, and the sewing machines, about 250 of them at 8 long tables. I got my paycheck, and I went to the dressing room for my coat and hat. I was standing there talking to some girls when I heard a noise like a big puff. I wanted to go to the dressing room for my hat, but somebody says to me, "Save yourself." Everybody was running to the Washington Place door. It was locked. Girls in shirtwaists, which were on fire, went flying out of the building so that you saw these young women burning as they flew. There were 3 stairs leading up to the roof with flames running over them. I ran up the stairs to the roof. When I came out on the roof, there were firemen. Instead of going down to save the people, they were saving the building.
We come marching, marching, unnumbered women dead. though crying through our singing. Their ancient cry for bread, small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits knew. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too.
Working on this material was fascinating for the members of the Actors Company Theater because they were girls. They were like every girl you ever knew, that it happened on a beautiful Saturday afternoon with the streets filled with people who all watched this tragedy, that they could not get out, that doors were locked, the fire ladders didn't go up, that there was no way for these people to escape. The way the factory was set up, you couldn't have designed something that would have turned into a furnace any faster. And then to have no fire escapes ready, nowhere to go. They tried to pull the fire hoses out from the floor above and they didn't work. All over there were the stories of humanity of it, and you read their accounts, and that it happened so quickly. The majority of the fire was over in 7 or 8 minutes. And 146 people died. And so many of them died, took their chances, and they decided they'd rather die on the sidewalk than in the inferno behind them because they were jumping to their certain death. 9 stories. The building where the Actors Company Theater has our studio is in the same period as the Ash Building. So that when we're on our floor, which is the 9th floor, that's exactly the height. And all we have to do is go over and look out the window and look down at what 80 feet is and how high that was and all of these people jumping.
One of the things that I was reading about was that in Eastern Europe after the fire happened, there were so many people who had daughters or nieces or granddaughters who were working in some kind of factory in America. Almost everybody was convinced that their daughter had died in the fire. I think that that story really says something because these were real girls. They're just like everybody I know. And in a sense, they were just everybody's daughters. And all the ones who came to America, they came to have a better life and a better shot at the things that make life bearable, like Rose Schneiderman says. And it's just so unfair that they were taken for granted that the way they were, that they had to lose their lives for that. Just trying to have a good life, I think, is just so tragic. And then the other thing is how human they were, and like the girl I play, Ethel, who doesn't forget to take her fur muff with her when she's trying to escape the fire. I find that very moving.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
They bring home asbestosis and silicosis, prolonged long black lung disease. And the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than just a little paycheck. We're bringing more than just a little paycheck. We're bringing more than just a little paycheck.
But I don't want no more. Don't accept no more.
Go
tell them boy no more.
Now, Frances Perkins, Secretary of Labor under President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
I happened to have been visiting a friend in the park, and we heard the engines and we heard the screams and rushed out. We could see this building from Washington Square, and the people had just begun to jump when we got there. They'd been holding until that time, standing in the windowsills, crowding, being crowded by others behind them. The fire pressing closer and closer, the smoke closer and closer. Finally, the men were trying to put up a net to catch people if they do jump. And they were trying to get that out, and they couldn't wait any longer. I mean, they began to jump. This one, the window was too crowded, and they would jump, and they hit the sidewalk. The net broke. The empty, a terrible distance. The weight of the bodies was so great at the speed at which they were traveling that they broke through the net. Every one of them was killed. Everybody who jumped was killed. It was a horrifying spectacle. The next day, people, as they heard about it in other parts of the city, they began to gather and talk. And the next Sunday, a meeting was called in the Metropolitan Opera House. By this time, we got a little sense of organization of something must be done. We've got to turn this into some kind of constructive action. We must make sure that this kind of thing can never happen again. And so, almost immediately at this meeting, people spoke. And I never forget, this was the first time I ever had heard Rose Schneiderman speak. She was a little red-headed girl, fiery red hair and blazing eyes. She had a voice that was that carried in the Metropolitan Opera House. Wonderful, what a speech she made. And I remember how moved we all were by this girl, who was a member of the Ladies' Dress and Waist Union. Rose Schneiderman.
I would be a traitor to these poor burned bodies if I came here to talk good fellowship. We have tried, you good people of the public, and we have found you wanting. The old Inquisition had its rack and its thumbscrews and its instruments of torture with iron teeth. We know what these things are today. The iron teeth are our necessities. The thumbscrews, the high-powered and swift machinery close to which we must work. And the rack is here, in the fireproof structures that will destroy us the minute they catch on fire. This is not the first time girls have been burned alive in the city. Every week I must learn of the untimely death of one of my sister workers. Every year thousands of us are maimed. The life of men and women is so cheap, and property is so sacred. There are so many of us for one job, it matters little if 143 of us are burned to death. We have tried, you citizens. We are trying you now. And you have a couple of dollars for the sorrowing mothers and daughters and sisters by way of a charity gift. But every time the workers come out in the only way they know to protest against conditions which are unbearable, the strong hand of the law is allowed to press down heavily upon us. Public officials have only words of warning to us, warning that we must be intensely orderly and must be intensely peaceable, and they have the workhouse just back of all their warnings. The strong hand of the law beats us back when we rise into the conditions that make life bearable. I can't talk fellowship to you who are gathered here. Too much blood has been spilled. I know from my experience, it is up to the working people to save themselves. The only way they can save themselves is by a strong working class movement.
Of course, we appointed a committee to carry on, and we decided to ask the legislature to create a commission. And this was an extraordinary opportunity to devise ways and means to prevent accidents by fire in the state of New York. We went on and kept expanding the function of the commission and all kinds of unsafe conditions, and then to long hours, low wages, the labor of children, the overwork of women, including homework put out by the factories to be taken home by the women, seems in some way to have paid the debt that society owed to those children, those young people who lost their lives in the Triangle Fire. It's their contribution that we have this series of legislative acts to protect and improve the administration of the law.
Those who have died have never left, but yet have a pact with the living. They are in the woman's breast, they are in the waiting child, they are with us in the home, they are with us in the crowd, but yet have a pact with the living.
Spring, over 78 years later. Triangle's now part of a university, with offices and polished intellect, arched, unwired windows, hydraulically controlled and unlocked doors, air conditioning, swivel chairs, marble floors, and fire alarms. But oh, hundreds of flowering girls still roam, hundreds of blushing spring girls still roam. 80 years later, in the paint, in the chrome, in the swivel of chairs, hundreds of blossoms twirling in the air, daring to descend if ever, oh ever, the fire comes again. Yes, like lead they will drop if ever, oh ever, the fire comes again. To hundreds of flowering girls, smell them in the rain, iris, peonies, magnolias, bending for the rain.
Red and roses, red and
now, Professor Mei Chen, former Vice President, International Ladies Garment Workers Union.
The workers were trying to organize a triangle factory before the fire, and there were union members working inside the factory. To the end, those employers were very, very resistant and would not allow the factory to organize. The fire forced the employers as a group to kind of back down in terms of their more vicious anti-union or anti-worker activities. So after the fire, a lot of the organizing by the workers to demand recognition of the unions and the negotiation between the employer associations and the union was able to take hold, so that large numbers of factory workers were successful at becoming part of the union and then becoming a part of master contracts, which tried to equalize some of the standards in the industry. Clara Lemlich stood up, and she inspired the declaration of March 8th as International Women's Day, because in the strike meeting and all those men union leaders sitting on the stage still going through all the pros and cons and what should we do and whatnot, and she just says, there's enough talk, it's time to take action, and we should go on strike. The labor movement is one of the key democratic forces that can push back through its organizing against the ravages of capital. When unions mobilize the workers to take action, it's a very powerful force. You challenge the policymakers or the capital employers' assumptions. Things have to be this way because we don't have money or the pensions. The Triangle Fire, some of the main lessons relate to organizing, because the garment workers were organizing both before and then aggressively after the fire. When the fire happened, it called a lot of attention to these workers, because there was already an awareness that these workers were trying to fight exploitative conditions and poor treatment on the job and no protections and no minimum wage.
Red and roses, red and roses. Red and roses, red and roses.
Through global capitalism today, they now have zones where they have manufacturing, and they have large factories. Like the stories we've heard from Mexico and other, and China and other places, the workers are often locked in the factory, working very long hours. When a fire breaks out, then there's bound to be injuries and death. The health and safety issues in the workplaces, whether they're here or in other countries, are very important. In the last several decades, you've seen a total erosion of a lot of the New Deal attitudes. And in the garment industry, because there's been such tremendous outsourcing and globalization, the employers feel like anything that's produced here had to compete with production in a third world country. So you've seen in the garment industry and in many low-wage industries the reemergence of sweatshops, because there's nothing wrong with sweating labor or cheating the clock. There's no sense that there should be any social concern or benevolence by the employer towards the workers. There's no appreciation that workers produce for the employer. There's really a wholesale attitude that the employer is the boss, and the boss can demand whatever he wants, and if you don't fulfill what he wants, you're gone. Even in the union workplaces of the garment industry, there began to be this huge competition with non-union as well as sweatshop labor and third world labor, so that many of the companies in New York just packed up and closed down. It's just become a real race to the bottom. Employers are much more vicious, and workers lost a lot of their feeling that they're able to fight. It was very heartbreaking, as a lot of workers that we were trying to represent who had different complaints, even back wage claims, felt like they didn't want to come forward because their company would just close and they would just totally lose their job. Ultimately, the actual real bodies in the street, meetings and organizing, which is the lesson of Triangle that has to come back to the fore today. That's the main hope and message, is that the Triangle commemoration after 100 years supports a new resurgence of organizing and fighting for positive changes for workers.
Our life shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses.
You've been listening to Out of the Flames, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and Its Legacy, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Special thanks to the Actors Company Theaters, Nora Chester and Victoria Mack. Music provided by Bev Grant, Pat Humphreys, and Sweet Honey in the Rock. Poetry by Sophia Henderson Holmes. And thanks to the Murphy Institute for Workers' Education and Labor Studies for introductory script assistance.